From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The air is rife
Brooke
with...
Brooke, you're back.
Yes, hey. Bob. How have you been?
Fantastic. Oh, keep talking. I'm so happy to hear your voice. Talk.
The air is rife with apology.
For over 50 years, providing you with safe, reliable, high-quality vehicles has been our first priority.
Toyota is mending fences just as fast as it can.
In recent days, our company hasn't been living up to the standards that you've come to expect from us. Or that we expect from ourselves.
And not a moment too soon. According to a study released this week by Kelley Blue Book, which assesses car values and prices for buyers and sellers, more than 27% of those who were considering a Toyota prior to the recall now say they no longer are. And the Toyota brand has dropped to third place behind Ford and Chevrolet. How humiliating.
I apologize for the great inconvenience and concerns of our customers due to recalls for multiple models in multiple regions.
Believe me, Toyota's car is safety, but we are trying to increase our product better.
Toyota President Akio Toyoda, less than a year into the job, was supposed to carry the company into the future, a challenging task because of the clash of cultures. Not just the clash between America and Japan, though that's a big one. There's also the clash between corporate and consumer culture. And in the history of corporate-consumer relations, one recall stands alone as the gold standard, the unreachable star, the apotheosis of right thinking in the face of Armageddon, the great Tylenol recall of 1982.
Seven people died this week in Chicago after taking extra-strength Tylenol capsules that had been laced with cyanide. By week's end, all Tylenol products were taken off the market in Chicago.
Gene Grabowski is the senior vice president of Levick Strategic Communications, which has offered PR advice to beleaguered entities ranging from spinach growers to the Vatican. He says Johnson & Johnson had a number of factors in its favor during the Tylenol recall. Its management had already worked out a crisis strategy plan. It had a charismatic CEO in James E. Burke, and its problem was caused by a homicidal maniac, not bad business practice. Tylenol in 1982 was the most successful over-the-counter product in America.
It could have very easily been destroyed in a couple of months. When you think back on the Tylenol recall, that was a leap of faith, but they took it. And the reason they took it was they thought like their customer. What would they expect of a company?
Well, specifically, they could expect Johnson & Johnson to swiftly pull the product off the shelves, explain the problem, accept responsibility, hold press conferences, go on 60 Minutes, set up a consumer hotline, and most important, invent tamper-proof caps. But generally, consumers should expect companies to take...
four steps, basically. Identify what the problem is, apologize, then very quickly describe what it is you're going to do to make sure this doesn't happen again, and then do it. Follow through on your promise.
So, if Johnson & Johnson set the template in 1982, which, by the way, the U.S. Defense Department now uses as a case study in crisis communication strategy, why didn't it catch on? Why has no other company, even Johnson & Johnson in later recalls, pulled it off so well?
It's not so much that the example didn't catch on. It's that the delivery of those messages and having the corporate courage to do so has always been in short supply. When a crisis hits, typically what happens is corporate executives at the top huddle together and worry about the stock price, worry about their image, worry about production, worry about profits and losses. And the one thing they should be focused on is, what is that mother of three thinking about my product right now? It's so simple that almost nobody will accept it.
Hi, I'm Jim Lentz, president of Toyota Motor Sales USA. And I want to let you know that we've developed a comprehensive plan to fix the sticking pedal situation in recalled Toyota vehicles.
Lentz issued this apology on February 1st, weeks after the current recall crisis exploded and years after Toyota fended off mounting safety concerns with reflexive opacity and denial, all of which reflects that other cultural clash, the one between the U.S. and Japan.
Thank you for your patience and understanding.
The New York Times recently drew attention to the exaltation in some precincts of American business that the star car company, the star pupil, so to speak, had been laid low by hubris. It was the joy in another's misfortune called Schadenfreude.
Well, that's the operative word, and not just in the American media response, but also the administration's response, and particularly Ray LaHood.
Roland Kelt, author of Japan America, How Japanese Pop Culture Has Invaded the U.S., is referring to Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood's suggestion, since withdrawn, that Toyota owners stop driving their cars.
You know, for anyone over, 25, 30 in Japan, memories of the Japan bashing in the 1980s are very stark, very painful. Where, you know, you literally saw in the United States, and many people forget this, politicians and auto workers smashing Toyotas and Nissans on American television with sledgehammers to protest what they felt were unfair export policies. Now, in Japan, the memory of that is that we learned to play the game by American rules. We learned to participate in this capitalist economy, and we succeeded, and then we got smashed for it. So there's a great wound, a great bruise at the very least, in the Japanese psyche over those Japan bashing days.
On the other hand, Kelt says that once Japan learns a lesson, it stays learned. He says that Akio Toyota's recent activities, sending an op-ed to the Washington Post, speaking directly to American consumers, phoning Ray LaHood, are revolutionary in the context of corporate Japan. In fact, one day Japan may outperform America in dealing with corporate crises, because if you consider that the 1982 Tylenol recall was the moon landing of corporate consumer relations, America planted the flag, but it hasn't been back there since. For journalists covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, charges of bias are an inevitable occupational hazard. New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief Ethan Bronner has reported with scrupulous fairness from the region on and off for a quarter century. But recently, his 20-year-old son decided to join the Israel Defense Forces. New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt was among several media watchers who said Bronner should be reassigned. Times executive editor Bill Keller disagrees.
Can a gay reporter write about the issue of same-sex marriage? Can you assign a reporter of African descent to cover Africa or of Indian descent to cover India? All of those things we've done. In the end, it has to come down to a complicated judgment, and the judgment is really, is this reporter capable of laying this baggage aside and writing fairly on this subject?
You said in your response to Hoyt that obviously, when there is a financial conflict of interest, if you own stock in a company, you shouldn't cover that company. But how is a financial stake an instant disqualifier, but having your child at risk in an armed conflict isn't?
It's one of the paradoxes of trying to apply ethics to journalism. Financial interests are easy to measure, but when you get into the realm of personal attachments, it becomes much more complicated, and that's why our ethics policy doesn't try to prescribe an outcome. It tries to alert us to be sensitive to the potential for a conflict of interest, discuss it with the reporter, and make a judgment.
Is there something about this particular story, you know, one that is so fraught, that would perhaps demand an even more excruciatingly close examination of potential conflicts?
The fact is that this particular situation has had an excruciating level of attention and examination both on our parts and outside of the paper. The flip side of that, though, is that this story is so fraught that you want to be maybe extra careful not to be panicked into saying, oh no, this reporter can't cover that story, even though he's by consensus one of the best reporters on this story. You know, where I disagree with Clark is the notion that you take an excellent, scrupulous reporter off his assignment entirely because of the potential that somebody will think it looks bad.
You know, a lot of people in new media say that this whole argument over appearances is old and stupid, that the best vaccination is simply to disclose, 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 Do you think that the Times is moving slowly towards the idea that disclosure is better than simply shearing people of any possible appearance of conflict of interest?
Well, I think disclosure works in some cases. You know, if you have a book reviewer writing about a book and the reviewer has written something that people could perceive as a competing book, you know, we disclose that in the book review, for example. But, you know, in an institution this size, the idea that you're going to manage to disclose every potentially relevant piece of information about every journalist on a staff of, you know, 1,150 people is kind of absurd.
It's actually not. It's quite easy for a reporter to write an intellectual and experiential bio, stick it up there one time, maybe update it occasionally, and have it there for all to see.
Maybe, but what is a reader entitled to know about a reporter?
That's the question. If they knew everything, then they would have to just decide on the basis of the work, mm-hmm. and the guessing games and the gotchas would go away.
I'm not sure that readers want that, and I'm not sure that it would be worth the effort to do it, but, you know, maybe that's the direction we're moving in.
Was there a period at the Times when Ethan Bronner would have been automatically reassigned?
There was a period of time when Ethan wouldn't have been assigned to the Jerusalem Bureau in the first place because he's a Jew. The first Jewish correspondent who covered Israel for the New York Times was Tom Friedman. And at the time, that was regarded as something of a breakthrough.
Bill, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times.
Coming up, vintage Bin Laden tapes feature jihadis in the kitchen.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A couple of months ago, the House passed Resolution 2278, aimed at Arab satellite TV networks like Al Jazeera. It says that any network that incites violence against Americans will be censured by the U.S. It was largely unnoticed by the U.S. press, but it sparked a huge controversy in the Arab media. Satellite networks play a vital role in the Middle East because they can be received across borders, out of the reach of repressive regimes that would have shut them down. To Middle East media watchers, any effort to bear down on networks like Al Jazeera, especially by a nation that regards itself as a free speech citadel, smacks of hypocrisy. Also, critics complain the bill is badly written. George Washington University professor Mark Lynch says that when the bill tries to define incitement, it ends up basically outlawing Arab journalism.
It's the act of persuading, encouraging, instigating, advocating, pressuring, or threatening so as to cause another to commit a violent act against any person, agent, instrumentality, or official of a representative of the United States. Simply reporting on something the United States does, which makes Arabs angry, could technically fall into that definition. Doing an interview with a political leader who criticizes the United States could technically fall into that category.
I gather some Arab leaders are against this, but others are maybe pretty happy with it. I'm thinking of Egypt, for example, and Hosni Mubarak.
Yes, Arab governments really don't like Al Jazeera. They don't like media freedoms, and they want to control the media. They score some political points by telling the United States to back off, but I don't believe for a second that they would be sad to see Al Jazeera muzzled. The strange thing is that the United States would put itself on the side of the muzzlers.
Well, that's what's so peculiar about this. It seems to me that if you wanted to do exactly the wrong thing in terms of the psychology of the Arab street, it would be to appear hypocritical and suppress press freedom where it's only beginning to flourish.
Well, especially in the context of Hillary Clinton's big speech about internet freedom, this is all over the op-ed pages in Arab newspapers. Now, this resolution just comes out of the House. I wouldn't be surprised, and I quite hope, that it'll simply die in the Senate and won't be heard from again. It's not administration policy, but as it's reported in the Middle East, those distinctions aren't really drawn. And so I think it's because it's gotten so much attention in the Arab media, the U.S. is already paying a cost for it.
Now, we've discussed Al Jazeera, but what about the other pan-Arab satellite channels? Have they anything to fear?
Again, it really depends on how broadly it's defined, and here's where the political interests would likely come in. Take something like Khalid Mishal, who's the political leader of Hamas. No self-respecting Arab TV station can afford to not interview him. So if they're going to define any contact with Khalid Mishal as incitement to anti-American violence, then pretty much every TV station would have something to fear. More likely, you'd end up seeing distinctions between television stations which are pushing a pro-American agenda, where they might say, well, yeah, sure, they interviewed Mishal, but on balance, they're basically sending a pro-American message, versus other stations where they wouldn't get the benefit of that doubt.
Now, it is understandable that the U.S. Congress is not happy that satellite TV channels, especially in countries that are nominally U.S. allies or receive U.S. aid, are broadcasting actual incitement, you know, to kill Americans and so forth. Historically, what kind of channels have been used to get the message to the host countries to get things under control?
I mean, I think that this really came to the fore about Iraq, where American officials in the Bush administration were really unhappy with a lot of the coverage on the Arab TV stations. I think a lot of that was displacement. TV stations weren't creating the incidents, they weren't creating the anger, but they were getting that story out, and it was very, very frustrating to American officials. So, for example, the Iraqi government, back when the Americans were still more or less running the place, they closed down the Baghdad offices of several TV stations, including Al Jazeera and also Al Arabiya, the Saudi station. They shut them down for various stretches of time. But I think at the end of the day, these Arab TV stations are covering reality. And if they are asked to, for example, not pay a lot of attention to Israel's attack on Gaza, they just can't take that advice because they'll lose all of their credibility.
Okay, Mark, as always, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Mark Lynch is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University and a blogger for Foreign Policy magazine. Not long after the United States invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001, CNN got a hold of 1,500 audio cassettes from the Kandahar compound of Osama bin Laden. CNN gave the tapes to U.S. officials, who found them of no immediate intelligence value and passed them along to academics for further study. Enter Flagg Miller, a professor of religious studies at the University of California at Davis. He's been translating and transcribing the tapes for the past 7 years. Miller says the tapes contain more than 200 different voices, many of them mujahideen who were intimately involved in planning attacks on Western targets in the years leading up to September 11th.
What's interesting in listening to the tapes is just how much debate there was even at that time, both about who was in charge, but also what the goals were of the militancy movement. What's fascinating is to kind of hear the speakers deal with these questions of uncertainty and try to bridge gaps in ways that might lend the movement some kind of coherence.
There is one tape that is labeled Osama bin Laden's 1996 Declaration of War. And this is a tape that we've heard before, but at some point in the tape, bin Laden veers off into poetry. And you think that that's significant?
Well, bin Laden in summer of 1996 was at the lowest point of his career. He was stateless for the first time, having been kicked out of the Sudan, where he'd lived for a good 6 years before that. He was stripped of his Saudi citizenship. He wasn't in position to declare war against anybody. And so in this speech, he has to kind of really ramp up the stakes of conflict with the West and somehow claim the mantle of leadership. Much of the first part of the speech, and there's a full recording of this on one of the tapes in the collection, focuses on legal arguments for why Muslims should individually sign up for jihad and fight the West. But he also confronts the bulk of legal consensus in the Muslim world that is strongly against individuals launching jihad wherever they are. So he has to back off of his legal commitments and say, well, in fact, there are other reasons. And he then comes up with some wild narratives about the ways in which Muslim youth today can fill the shoes of the companions who fought alongside the Prophet in the 7th century. And he then moves into poetry to rally the emotions of listeners.
You know, there's an expression in advertising, if you've got nothing to say, sing it. Is that what you're suggesting is going on here?
Very much that kind of thing. You know, poetry throughout the Muslim world taps deeply into cultural beliefs, into values. It's used by villagers. It's used by political elites. And Bin Laden can cite poetry at ease. He composes his own verse. And frequently in translations of the 96 Declaration, this stuff drops out. But when you hear this poetry on audio cassette, you hear the intensity of Bin Laden's voice. She's addressing William Perry, the former Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration, in a challenge to man-to-man combat. And he says, here's what the Muslim youth say to you. Tomorrow, William, you will discover which young man will confront your brethren who have been deceived by their own leaders. And then he moves into a poem. A youth who plunges into the smoke of war, smiling. He hunches forth, staining the blades of lances red. May God not let my eye stray from the most eminent humans, should they fall. As the stallion bears my witness that I hold them back, my stabbing is like the cinders of fire that explode into flame. His vision for himself as a cosmic warrior who can transcend the constraints of time and space and take on the West is nowhere more apparent than in this material. And it's a material that speaks to cultural memories of glory, honor, tribal manliness, and dignity, broadly writ, for Muslim communities.
There is another tape in which you hear a bunch of mujahideen milling around the kitchen making breakfast?
Well, one of the tapes starts and there's a strange kind of static noise. There's some clinking, popping, and then someone says, air, 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 give it some air. Don't you notice that its voice is weak? It needs air, I mean, with force. So I'm listening to this and I'm not sure kind of they're pumping something up, like is it some kind of communications balloon? And then the conversation continues. Someone else says, ooh, you see now, engineers are we. And it turns out it's a cook and he's pumping up a kerosene stove to make eggs. He says, engineers are we, engineers of eggs. And they reflect on the fact that here they are, they've traveled from around the world, they've come to fight this glorious battle, but the battle has not yet begun, and there are days in which they're waiting for something to happen. And so isn't it ironic that here they are, jihadis, in the kitchen?
Now, it must be weird for you to see these guys doing such human things, guys who would go on, some or maybe even many of them, maybe all of them, to be mass murderers. They killed thousands of people in 6 or 7 or 8 countries. And you hear them joking around. What is that like to see the human side?
One of the things these tapes teach us is the complexity of these individuals. And it's understanding the dynamism of militancy as a creative and adaptive strategy that will better allow us to defeat them. And that can only come through carefully listening to their arguments and understanding how they appeal to listeners as human beings and how they try as best they can to portray their more violent vision in sympathetic terms. That's difficult to listen to, but it's nevertheless important.
Well, Flagg, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to talk.
Flagg Miller is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of California at Davis.
In March of 2005, Leslie Weiss obtained tickets from her local representative for an upcoming town hall meeting with then-President George W. Bush in Denver, Colorado. She and a companion arrived for the meeting, a public event paid for with taxpayer dollars, driving a car with a bumper sticker that read, "No More Blood for Oil." 5 minutes after they were seated and before the president started his talk, they were unseated without explanation by White House event staffers. A few days later, Weiss met with authorities in Colorado who told her the explanation for her ejection could be found on her bumper. The American Civil Liberties Union later filed suit against the White House event staffers who forcibly removed Ms. Weiss and her companion, and just a couple of weeks ago lost the decision. A 3-member panel of the 10th Circuit Court voted 2-1 against the plaintiffs. ACLU senior counsel Chris Hansen argued the case.
We argued that the plaintiffs' First Amendment rights were violated, that the government can't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. That is, it can't decide to only allow people to say yay and not to say nay, or vice versa. It can't allow only Republicans to speak and not Democrats, or vice versa. And this was an instance in which it seemed to us our plaintiffs were excluded from the event because of their viewpoint. We thought that was about as basic a First Amendment violation as there could be, and so we sued.
Now, these guys didn't disrupt the event in any way?
That's right, they didn't. First of all, they weren't allowed in the event for long enough time that they could have disrupted. But second, and more importantly, they weren't there to disrupt. They were there to listen quietly and respectfully to the president express his views on Social Security.
Well, we appreciate you coming today. We're going to have a serious dialogue on Social Security. It's an issue that requires a lot of dialogue and a lot of discussion.
So let's talk about the defendants. They include Michael Casper and several others who were White House event staffers at the town meeting that day in Denver and who participated in the decision to eject Ms. Weiss and her companion from the hall. How did the lawyers who represented them argue their side?
The defendants essentially argued that the law was not clearly established, that there was no First Amendment right to participate in a meeting, and that therefore it was perfectly legitimate to be able to exclude people from the meeting.
As you say, it seems to be a very clear First Amendment issue. Why do you think you lost the case?
Well, I think the matter has become confused in the last few years by a couple of Supreme Court decisions, most notably a case involving the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Boston. The question in the St. Patrick's Day Parade case was whether the organizers of the St. Patrick's Day Parade could exclude gay marchers from their parade. And the Supreme Court ultimately said, yes, it's their parade. They get to decide who marches in their parade. When you have a private entity that has gotten a space for its private use, they get to use it for whatever they want to, and they can exclude people if they want to.
Even if it's a public street that they're using for their private use?
Yes, even if it's a public street. A Republican doesn't have the right to march in the Democratic parade, and a Democrat doesn't have a right to march in the Republican parade. Similarly, if the president goes to speak at an occasion where he is the head of the party, like a fundraiser or a campaign rally, almost everybody agrees that in those instances, it's probably permissible for the president, as the head of the party, to exclude people from his event. The difference, though, is in this case, the president was not speaking as head of the Republican Party. He was speaking as the president of the United States, and we think the president of the United States represents all of us. But presidents often try to control the nature of the message whenever they're speaking. They don't like having dissident views in the audience or along the parade route or along the motorcade route. And so it's relatively common for not only President Bush, but prior presidents to try to control that. Up until this point, no court has ever allowed presidents to do that. And this is the first time, as far as we're aware, a court has suggested that that might be permissible.
Have there been any other cases along these lines? I seem to remember an offending T-shirt at another President Bush event.
There was at the state capitol in West Virginia. It was a 4th of July rally, again open to the public, again paid for by taxpayers. Two clients who I also represented wore T-shirts that had the red circle with a line through it and the president's name. They were arrested and held in jail for a couple of hours. We ultimately sued the people involved in that case, and the case settled for money damages.
How did the Bush staffers in the current case know that Ms. Weiss's car had that bumper sticker?
Good question, and the answer is we don't know. One of the peculiarities of modern constitutional law is that the defendants get to move to dismiss on the basis of qualified immunity before any discovery takes place. And so that's what happened here, and we've never gotten any discovery, and we don't really know how the people at the White House knew about the bumper sticker.
So where does the ACLU go from here?
Well, we think the decision is wrong, and we have asked the entire Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals to review the panel's decision in the hopes that the entire court will overturn the panel's decision. If that's unsuccessful, then our next step is to decide whether to ask the United States Supreme Court to hear the case or not.
How good do you think your chances are there?
Even the conservatives on the Supreme Court have been fairly strong supporters of free speech rights, and so we wouldn't take it to the Supreme Court unless we thought we had a shot of winning it.
Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Chris Hansen is Senior National Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union.
Coming up, what the ever-changing image of schizophrenia says about us all.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's a saying that goes, a good book is the best of friends, the same today and forever. Consider the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, that catalog of mind-based maladies designated by the American Psychiatric Association. Plagued by fears or fantasies, bad thoughts or bad behaviors, if the problem's in your head, it's in the DSM, charting your psychic pain since 1952. The next edition, the fifth in 60 years, isn't due out until 2013. But this week, the American Psychiatric Association released a first draft of DSM-5 for public comment. So now is the time when new disorders are debated. That's why we're rerunning the piece you're about to hear. This is a very big deal.
Because the disorder definitions that we provide are used by the FDA to determine whether or not new medication might have an indication for treatment.
Dr. Darrell Regier is the vice chair of the DSM-5 task force.
It's used by the NIH to assess the type of disorder that somebody is asking to research. It's also used by Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies to identify the condition that somebody is requesting payment of treatment for.
Most important, it's used by doctors to define what's normal and what's not. It was the DSM that officially declared homosexuality a mental disorder, and then in 1973, officially undeclared it. It's defined an ever-expanding range of phobias and addictions that we're still arguing about. But this time, demands for more transparency aim to crack open the window on DSM deliberations so interested parties can weigh in on disorders before they are enshrined. Because once they are, the FDA approves drugs to treat them, and any further debate is drowned out in the flood of direct-to-consumer ads.
Premenstrual dysphoric disorder.
PMDD, a form of PMS affecting roughly 5% of menstruating women. It's so severe, it impairs their ability to function.
First and only prescription medication for PMDD.
When the Seraphim commercials came out was when I got, you know, the aha.
Steph Prose was being treated for depression, even though she rejected that diagnosis and felt stigmatized by it. When she saw the Seraphim ad depicting her rages and her guilt, she finally felt she had a real diagnosis and was deeply relieved and grateful.
And immediately I called my doctor and said, "This is what I have. I want depression taken off the records."
Like so much in the DSM, the diagnosis of PMDD is a judgment call. But Steph Prose, who blogs about it at lifewpmdd.com, has no trouble passing judgment on whether it should be in the DSM.
My answer is yes. Trying to go to work every day and getting the energy to do it, it does. It affects you every single day. And to me, that is a disorder.
PMDD has languished in the appendix of the DSM, signifying that the jury is still out. It's a hot-button issue because, you know, this one's just for the ladies and could be used against them. All of them.
I hadn't really thought about it. I guess the way I look at it is kind of a sexist disease.
Sarafem, just Prozac and Pink, is still available, but the FDA demanded that Eli Lilly pull the ads because they described the symptoms of PMDD so broadly that they were virtually indistinguishable from what most women experience as PMS, a condition not currently up for inclusion in the DSM.
If we're in the business of treating PMS with psychiatric drugs, in part what we're saying is that there is a level of insanity to the suffering of PMS.
Jonathan Metzl, psychiatrist and author of Prozac on the Couch, prescribing gender in the era of wonder drugs.
We know that when the industry drives diagnosis, there's a process that happens that Peter Kramer, in listening to Prozac, beautifully described as diagnostic bracket creep. People start to come into doctors' offices and say, I know this drug is indicated for a particular illness, but I've kind of got that. And the doctor says, that sounds good enough. We'll give you this medication. And what happens over time is that the diagnostic boundaries expand and expand and expand, so that a drug that was indicated for a very small subset of people over time becomes indicated and used for a much wider category.
50% of the population defines itself as shy.
Christopher Lane is the author of Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness.
Enormous number of people have a profound dislike of speaking in public, but that doesn't mean they suffer from a psychiatric condition. And the effort on the part of these psychiatrists and the APA to broaden the net and include internet addiction and compulsive buying disorder and apathy disorder, relational disorder, all of these are basically codes for everyday experiences and fears and anxieties that should not be represented in a psychiatric Bible.
The issue with all mental disorders is they're defined in terms of symptoms that we all experience every day as part of normal living.
Dr. Michael First worked on the third DSM and was an editor of the fourth.
Sadness, anxiety, palpitations, these are all normal phenomena. It's only when they're sufficiently severe enough and cluster together that they begin to look like they're a potential mental disorder. So if you add a mental disorder to the DSM and it's defined in terms of everyday symptoms, you always run the risk of labeling someone who is normal with having a disorder.
The DSM task force is keenly aware of the risk of what are called false positives, a risk driven home in 1972 by psychologist David Rosenhan, who conducted a study in which 8 mentally healthy people gained admission to 12 psychiatric hospitals in 5 states by claiming to hear a voice saying empty or hollow or thud. That was their only deception. Other than that, they behaved normally. All but one was diagnosed as schizophrenic. After admission, they said they felt fine and their behavior reflected it, but it took them from 7 to 52 days to be discharged with a diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. When the study was published, 2 psychiatric hospitals agreed to undergo the same test. Could they identify the fakers? In fact, they identified dozens of them. Only none had actually been sent.
One of the big challenges of psychiatric diagnosis is the fact that it's still descriptive. It's based upon the way patients present.
Is this why we're all desperate for genetics to come up with, hey, you have a super short, you know, Q gene, therefore that's the cause of your condition?
The reason why we haven't discovered the gene for schizophrenia is there is no gene for schizophrenia. It's a complex interaction of so many different factors. I would have imagined that after 15 years of research, given all of the advances, we'd have to have a lab test by now.
So diagnosis is still an art.
Still an art. But it's also art in the rest of medicine as well. I think anyone who's ever had back pain or an ill-defined medical illness will see how similar the rest of medicine can be to psychiatry.
Similar, but not the same. First concedes that the diagnoses of medical disorders rarely affect the culture as intensely as mental disorders do.
The DSM is an amalgam of social values and the science. I think the decisions made by the people in the DSM have direct impact on everyone.
That's why this veteran of DSM 3 and 4 stands firmly with critics who are calling for even more public deliberations.
You want to see, how did this group of individuals who are making these decisions come up with their decisions? And more importantly, you want to have advanced warning so that if a proposal starts pushing its way through, people are aware of what that proposal is. And if they see a problem with it, they'll write in and say, you know, you haven't considered this. It's the interaction and the give and take with the entire both scientific community and the community at large which can produce the best DSM. That's the big problem with not having full transparency. It really robs the book of very, very important input at the earliest possible stages.
What's more, members of the DSM-5 task force sign a contract pledging not to divulge any confidential information, defined as, quote, all work product, unpublished manuscripts and drafts, and other pre-publication material, group discussions, internal correspondence, information about the development process, and any other written or unwritten information in any form that emanates from or relates to my work with the APA task force or work group. But the APA says the contract has nothing to do with transparency. Dr. Daryl Regeer, vice chair of the current DSM-5 task force.
This particular section was written by the intellectual property attorneys, and their concerns were that individuals who have inside access to the entire process don't use this for personal gain. In fact, we've had quite a bit of input come in from the general public. The general public actually doesn't get that involved until it's clear what the disorders are and what the impact might be.
That's because they don't know what is under consideration.
Well, I think that you've seen a number of presentations in the press of people speculating about what might be under consideration.
Do you ever personally wonder that too much of the wide range of human behavior is being pathologized?
I worry about that a lot. And when I went into the field of psychiatric epidemiology, which is my research area, I was very concerned that in 1950s there was a book out called Midtown Manhattan Study that identified something like 84% of folks in Manhattan as having a mental disorder. So I've been concerned since that time of having something that is certainly much more credible. I think the DSM three criteria enabled us to narrow down on what is really a disorder and what is within the normal range of human, you know, emotional expression.
I think if you took the wide swath of depression disorders that are in the DSM and add them to the wide swath of anxiety disorders that are in the DSM and throw in quite a few of the attention disorders that are in the DSM, you could easily find that 84% of New Yorkers have a mental disorder.
I don't think you can.
Let's assume that the only goal of the DSM is to reduce the sum of human suffering. The APA has been asked to review conditions for inclusion in the book, like apathy disorder, internet addiction, and parental alienation disorder. Who among us cannot find ourselves somewhere in the DSM? Which prompts the question, not how much suffering is too much. We know mental illness destroys lives, but how much suffering is too little? Psychiatry has lowered our threshold for pain and has raised the bar for normal. Maybe the expectation that there is a normal is the most insidious disorder of all.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry. Be happy.
Schizophrenia has appeared in every edition of the DSM, but a constant presence doesn't mean a fixed definition. Over the years, the entry for schizophrenia has changed, partly because brain imaging technology has allowed researchers and psychiatrists to peer inside the patient's brains and trace the physiological trail of mental illness. But University of Michigan psychiatrist Jonathan Metzl, who we just heard from briefly, says imaging is not the only factor shaping our evolving view of schizophrenia. It's also shaped by our changing perspective on gender, race, and violence. In his new book, The Protest Psychosis, Metzl argues that schizophrenia looked very different in the first half of the 20th century, typified in the 1948 film The Snake Pit, in which Olivia de Havilland plays a middle-class woman who just 3 days after her wedding hears voices, sees hallucinations, and cannot recognize her own husband.
I have no husband.
You haven't? I thought you were married.
I am married. If you're married, doesn't that mean that you have a husband?
Virginia, darling, look at me. Don't you know who I am? I'm Robert. Virginia.
She undergoes psychotherapy from an all-knowing analyst and is reunited with her husband in the end. Jonathan Metzl says this is how we used to see schizophrenia, a disease of docility affecting white women.
And then all of a sudden you see the assumption about who got schizophrenia and how they acted changed very dramatically in the 1960s in the context of civil rights. And that's where you see this shift from an illness of docility to one of hostility. And then all of a sudden you see popular media and films replete with representations of African-American men who have gone crazy because they are in different ways participating in civil rights protests. For example, the movie Shock Corridor in 1963, which was another asylum film.
Let's talk about Shock Corridor. The main schizophrenic character wasn't an Olivia de Havilland housewife, but an African-American former civil rights protester named Trent, who apparently was driven insane by his thwarted attempts to desegregate America?
Basically, the pressure of trying to change Southern white civilization in the movie literally drives him insane to the point where he becomes a violent racist. And in the film's key scene, he actually starts a race riot on the ward.
Hallelujah! That one! Let's get that black boy before he marries my daughter! Hallelujah!
Starting in the early 1960s, you see increasing numbers of African-American men show up in depictions of schizophrenia. And the Shock Corridor is one excellent example of that, but there are many other examples from the media.
Some of them involve advertising.
Correct. Yeah, one of the main ads that I use, it's an ad for an antipsychotic medication called Haldol, and it shows an African-American man in the streets literally shaking his fist, and the text says, "Assaultive and belligerent, cooperation begins with Haldol." And again, this was a radical shift because ads in the 1950s for anti-schizophrenia medications showed docile white women. So all of a sudden in the 1960s and 1970s, you see these transformations.
And it was in 1968 that this evolution in the image of schizophrenia seems to have been solidified with the publication of the DSM-II. How did it redefine it?
There's new language in the definition of paranoid schizophrenia. They specifically add the terms aggression, hostility, and projection. But what I show in the book is that that language at the time in the 1960s was disproportionately used to diagnose black men.
How do you show that?
When these terms, aggression, hostility, and projection, were added to the DSM and appeared in psychiatric publications, 8 out of 10 articles, roughly, talked about black male subjects with schizophrenia. We applied a similar analysis to medical charts and again showed how that language purportedly was used to talk about mental illness, but unconsciously was a way of diagnosing race as well.
We've mentioned ads and movies. I'm just wondering, it's the chicken and the egg question, do the media reflect the changing definitions of the psychiatric community, or are they pushing them forward?
It does create a chicken and the egg question. In a lot of cases, the changing media representations predated the changing psychiatric ones. In other words, you could see terms like aggression or hostility or these representations of people like Trent and Shock Corridor showing up a good 5, 6, 7 years before that change happened in the DSM. The DSM is a cultural document, and it reflects its cultural environment as much as anything else.
How do you think schizophrenia should be defined? Do you think that hostility should be in there? Do you think split personality should be in there?
I would certainly say that I agree with the DSM right now. There is nothing about hostility or aggression or projection in the DSM. Those terms were thankfully taken out of the DSM. At the same time, there is research that consistently shows that schizophrenia is overdiagnosed in African American men. And so there is a particular racial valence around this diagnosis. And I think that paying attention to the ways in which schizophrenia intersects with certain racial stereotypes is very important for understanding cultural attitudes about this illness. It should be defined in terms of symptoms such as delusions, hallucinations, paranoia, debilitating symptoms that can ruin people's lives.
Jonathan Metzl is a professor at the University of Michigan and author of The Protest Psychosis, How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with help from Alex Goldman, and edited by
Brooke. Brooke is back in the house.
We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Bill Bowen.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Thank you for doing all of that editing while I was gone. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm the other one.
And you did so well, Bob.
Thank you, Brooke.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.